convert. You are not a good Muslim. You have spoken against us and you will face the consequences. The Mujahideen will find you wherever you go on the surface of the earth." It was starting to seem as if the Taliban had never really left. I tried to tell myself this terrible letter was just the futile and parting shot of a defeated Taliban. But still, I prayed for my father's safety every day. I prayed for my school to remain open and for the bombed-out schools to be rebuilt. I also continued to ask God to make me taller. If I was going to become a politician and work for my country, I told God, I would have to at least be able to see over the podium. Chapter 19. Good News at Last. One day in October 2011, my father called me over to show me an email he'd received. I could scarcely believe what it said. I had been nominated for the International Peace Prize of Kids' Rights, a children's advocacy group based in Amsterdam. My name had been put forward by Archbishop Desmond Tutu from South Africa, one of my father's greatest heroes because of his fight against apartheid. Then another email arrived. I was invited to speak at a conference on education in Lahore. The chief minister there was starting a new network of schools. All the children would receive laptop computers. He was awarding cash prizes to children all over his province who did well in their exams. And to my surprise, he was also giving me an award for my campaign for girls' rights. I wore my favorite pink shalwar kameez to the event and decided that I would tell everyone about how my friends and I in the girls' high school had defied the Taliban edict and continued going to school secretly. I wanted children everywhere to appreciate their education. So I said I now knew firsthand the suffering of millions of children who are deprived of an education. But, I told the audience, the girls of Swat were and are not afraid of anyone. I had been home barely a week when one of my friends burst into class one day and announced that I'd won another prize. The government had awarded me Pakistan's first National Peace Prize. I couldn't believe it. So many journalists descended on our school that day, it was a madhouse. I still hadn't grown an inch by the date of the award ceremony, but I was determined to be seen as authoritative nonetheless. When the Prime Minister presented me with the award, I presented him with a list of demands, including a request that he rebuild the schools destroyed by Fazlullah and that the government establish a girls' university in Swat. That sealed my determination to become a politician, so I could take action and not just ask for help from others. When it was announced that the prize would be awarded annually and be named the Malala Prize in my honor, I noticed a frown on my father's face. In our country's tradition, we don't honor people in this way while they are alive, only after they have died. He was a bit superstitious and thought it was a bad omen. My brothers, of course, kept me humble. They still fought with me and teased me and wrestled with me for the TV remote. I may have been getting attention from around the world, but I was still the same old Malala to them. I wondered, though, how my friends would take to all this publicity. We were a very competitive group, after all. And of course, there were always Moniba's feelings to consider. I worried that she'd think I'd abandoned her during my travels, or that she had taken up with a new best friend. But there was no time to think about this on my first day back at school. When I arrived, I was told there was a group of journalists waiting to interview me. When I entered the room, I saw all my school friends gathered round a cake, shouting, "Surprise!" They had taken up a collection and bought a white cake with chocolate icing that read, "Success Forever." My dear friends, they were as generous as could be and only wanted to share in my success. I knew in my heart that any one of us could have achieved what I had. I was lucky that I had parents who encouraged me despite the fear we all felt. Now you can get back to your schoolwork, Madame Mariam said as we finished our cake. Exams in March. Part 4. Targeted. Chapter 20. A death threat against me. One day, in early 2012, we were in Karachi as guests of GOTV, and a Pakistani journalist who lived in Alaska came to see us. She had seen the New York Times video and wanted to meet me. She also wanted to take my father aside and tell him something. I noticed that she had tears in her eyes. Then she and my father walked over to the computer. They looked troubled and hurriedly shut down whatever they'd been looking at. A short while later, my father's phone rang. He took the call out of earshot and came back inside looking very gray. "What is it?" I asked. "There's something you're not telling me." He had always treated me as an equal, but I could see he was trying to decide whether to protect me from this thing or to share it with me. He sighed heavily, then showed me what he'd been looking at on the computer. He Googled my name. "Malala Yousafzai," the Taliban said, "should be killed." There it was, in black and white, a death threat against me. I think I had known this moment might come someday. Now, here it was. I thought back to those mornings in 2009, when school first reopened and I had to walk to school with my books hidden under my scarf. I was so nervous in those days. But I had changed since then. I was 3 years older now. I had traveled and given speeches and won awards. Here was a call for my death. An invitation from one terrorist to another, saying, "Go ahead, shoot her." And I was as calm as could be. It was as if I were reading about someone else. I took another glance at the message on the screen. Then I closed the computer and never looked at those words again. The worst had happened. I had been targeted by the Taliban. Now I would get back to doing what I was meant to do. I might have been calm, but my dear father was near tears. "Are you all right, Jani?" he said. "Abba," I said, trying to reassure him. "Everybody knows they will die someday. No one can stop death. It doesn't matter if it comes from a Talib or from cancer." He wasn't convinced. "Maybe we should stop our campaigning for a while," he said. "Maybe we should go into hibernation for a time." My proud, fearless Pashtun father was shaken in a way I'd never seen. And I knew why. It was one thing for him to be a target of the Taliban. He had always said, "Let them kill me. I will die for what I believe in." But he had never imagined the Taliban would turn their wrath on a child. On me. I looked at my father's wretched face, and I knew that he would honor my wishes no matter what I decided. But there was no decision to make. This was my calling. Some powerful force had come to dwell inside me, something bigger and stronger than me, and it had made me fearless. Now it was up to me to give my father a dose of the courage he had always given me. "Abba," I said, "you are the one who said if we believe in something greater than our lives, then our voices will only multiply, even if we are dead. We can't stop now." He understood, but he said we should be careful about what we say and to whom we say it. On the trip back home, though, I asked myself what I would do if a Talib came to kill me. Well, I would just take my shoe and hit him. But then I thought, if you hit a Talib with your shoe, there is no difference between him and you. You must not treat others with cruelty. You must fight them with peace and dialogue. "Malala," I said to myself, "just tell him what is in your heart. That you want an education. For yourself. For all girls. For his sister. His daughter. For him." That's what I would do. Then I would say, "Now you can do what you want." Chapter 21. The Promise of Spring. By spring, the valley had begun to warm. The poplar trees had burst into bloom, and a tiny miracle in the campaign for education had taken place right in my own home. My mother had started learning to read. While my father and I were busy crisscrossing Swad, speaking out on behalf of the girls of our valley, my mother had started working with one of the teachers at the Khushal Primary School. Whenever Miss Ulfat had a break in her schedule, my mother would visit, her notebook and pencil in hand, until gradually the strange squiggles and symbols on the page revealed themselves to her. She was soon able to read Urdu and had started learning English. My mother loved schoolwork even more than I did, if that was possible. My father said it was because she had been deprived of learning for so long. In the evenings, she and I would often do our homework together, sipping tea, two generations of Pashtun women happily huddled over their books. Meanwhile, my own schoolwork had actually slipped a bit because of all my travels. I could hardly believe it, but Malka-e-Noor had come in first the previous term. And of course, Khushal seized the opportunity to tease me. While you were busy becoming the most famous student in Pakistan, your rival stole your crown at home, he said. But it hardly mattered. My friends and I were in high spirits because exams were finally over and our class was about to go on our first field trip in years. During Fazlullah's reign, all field trips had been cancelled since girls were not to be seen in public. Now, finally, our beloved springtime ritual was back. We travelled by bus to the famous White Palace, a wonder built of white marble so unearthly it floated like a cloud. My friends and I stared in awe at its rooms and gardens. Then we ran around, chasing one another, in the deep green forest. When we came upon a crystal waterfall, we all posed for pictures. One girl splashed another. The drops of water lit the air like diamonds. It was one of the most beautiful things I'd ever seen, and we all sat dreamily for a while, just listening to the rushing water. Then Moniba started splashing me again. I wasn't in the mood, so I told her to stop. But she did it again, and again. My father called for me, so I walked off. When I returned, she was angry with me for walking away. And once again, our typical foolishness put a damper on the day. We rode home in the bus, sulking in our separate seats. The next morning, a man came to our door with a photocopied letter. As my father read it to us, the color drained from his face. Dear Muslim brothers, there is a school, the Khushal School, which is a center of vulgarity and obscenity. They take girls for picnics to different resorts. Go and ask the manager of the White Palace Hotel, and he will tell you what these girls did. He put down the piece of paper. It has no signature, he said. We sat stunned. We knew nothing improper had happened on our field trip. Our phone began to ring. The letters, apparently, had been distributed all over the neighborhood and pasted on the walls of the mosque near our school. It was clear to us now that someone had spied on us during our school trip. And someone had gone to a lot of trouble to spread lies about us and our school. There was no denying it. The Taliban might have been defeated, but their beliefs were still spreading. Chapter 22. Omens. That summer, I turned 15. Many girls are married off by that age, and many boys have already left school to support their families. I was lucky. I would get to stay in school as long as I wanted. And as long as there was peace. Well, relative peace. The bomb blasts were down to only two or three a year, and you could pass by the green square without seeing the aftermath of a Taliban killing spree. But true peace seemed like nothing more than a memory or a hope. This birthday felt like a turning point for me. I was already considered an adult. That happens at age 14 in our society. But it was time for me to take stock, to think about my future. I knew for certain now that I wanted to be a political leader. I felt the word politics had a bit of a stain on it, but I would be different. I would do the things politicians only spoke of, and I would start with education, especially girls' education. Just because I no longer had to fight to go to school didn't mean I had any less interest in the cause. I had been given a lot of awards, and I started to feel that it was too much, that I didn't deserve it all. I saw so many children suffering still. Why should I be enjoying galas and ceremonies? I told my father I wanted to spend some of the money I'd received helping people who needed it. I had never forgotten the children I'd seen sorting trash at the dump all those years earlier. I wanted to help kids like them. So I decided to start an education foundation. I organized a meeting with 21 girls at school, and we discussed how we could help every girl in Swat get an education. We decided we would focus on street children and those in child labor. We had plans to keep talking, and then in the fall, we would decide what exactly we could do. In early August, my father received some frightening news. One of his close friends, Zahid Khan, had been attacked. Like my father, he was an outspoken opponent of the Taliban. On his way home from prayers one night, he was shot, point blank in the face. When my father got the news, he fell to his knees. It was as if he had been shot. "We were both on the Taliban list," he finally confessed to my mother. "People were just wondering which of us would be first." Although we had been told that the Taliban had fled, there was still violence in the valley. Whereas before, anyone in the region who happened to be caught in the crossfire was in danger, now the threat was mostly to those who had spoken against the Taliban in the past and who were continuing to campaign for peace. By some miracle, Zahid Khan survived. After that, though, I noticed a change in my father. He started to vary his routine each day. One day he would go to the primary school first thing in the morning, another day he would go to the girls' school, and the next to the boys. And before he stepped inside, he looked up and down the street 4 or 5 times to be sure he wasn't being followed. At night, he would come to my room, pretending he was there to say goodnight. But he was actually checking to make sure all my windows were locked. I knew what he was doing, so I'd say, "Abba, why have you closed the windows?" He'd reply, "Jani, I've closed the windows because I want you to be safe." "If the Taliban had wanted to kill me," I told him, "they should have done it in 2009. That was their time." He would shake his head at me and say, "No, you should be safe." My room was big and at the front of the house, and it had many windows. I did worry sometimes that a person could climb over the boundary wall and jump into my room. I also worried constantly that someone had forgotten to lock the gate. So after the rest of the family was asleep, I would tiptoe outside and check the lock. All that fall, odd things happened. Strangers came to the house asking my father questions about his friends and his family. My father told me they were from the intelligence services. Sometimes they came to the school and snooped around. There were little things, too. A teacher came to school hysterical one morning, saying she had had a nightmare about me. "You were badly hurt," the teacher said. "Your legs were on fire." And a picture of me that hung on a wall in our house mysteriously shifted overnight. My father, the gentlest man I know, was very upset when he discovered it hanging crooked the next morning. "Please put it straight," he snapped at my mother. I had started having nightmares too. Dreams where men threw acid in my face. Dreams where men snuck up behind me. Sometimes I thought I heard footsteps echoing mine when I turned down the alley in front of our house. And sometimes I imagined figures slipping into the shadows when I passed. I had also started thinking about death, wondering what it felt like. I didn't tell my parents about my dreams and fears, or even Moniba. I didn't want anyone